Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Dr. Oscar Cully Rice of Denver, Colorado. He'll be 96 in May, and he continues to occupy his magnificent mind with scientific breakthroughs he hasn't had time to complete yet. He came to America as a teenager, escaping the Holocaust, but not knowing what would become of his Jewish parents and other relatives in his native Germany. Before we left off, we heard about the courage he displayed while serving with the 79th Infantry Division and what he did to earn the Silver Star. But 3 days after that, he would be wounded in action and quite fortunate to survive. Dr. Rice, tell us what happened on March 27th, 1945.
The situation was as follows. There was a bridge across a fairly large river, not the size of the Rhine, but with binoculars you could see that there were bombs placed, explosives placed under the bridge. They were getting ready to blow the bridge up. And I went to the front line to observe what's going on. I did telephone the mayor of the city over on the other side, talked to him in German, but I didn't get any information that helped us really.
Did he know who you were?
No.
You basically prank called the mayor of the city to try to get intelligence?
Yeah.
How often did you do that?
That's the only time. The only other time I had contact with the mayor's office was in Alsace when I went to when we conquered the little town. And I went in the mayor's office. The mayor was gone, of course. And I opened the drawer of his desk. On the right side, there was the armband of the Free French. On the other side was the armband of the swastika.
That kind of illustrates politicians for you, doesn't it?
Right.
So anyway, so back to this. You call the mayor.
Yeah.
He doesn't give you anything.
No.
But so you're still there.
The only thing I learned is that there were only about one battalion of German soldiers stationed over there. But it did confirm that there were, in fact, German soldiers stationed on the other side of the bridge.
And what did you tell him to get him to tell you that?
Oh, I forgot. I pretending I was in German.
Just like a German civilian.
Yeah. I asked him, sind der Soldaten? Soldaten is the German name for soldiers. Soldaten. And he said, ja.
So at least you know there are some German soldiers there.
See, because if there wouldn't be any soldiers, our actions would be different. We would have waited. We wouldn't have waited so long. We wouldn't have gone on the bridge because we wouldn't have to take the casualties if we had done that. But there were soldiers there. They were obviously on the other side watching and ready to blow the bridge if we'd gone across.
So you're saying because of that phone call, you guys didn't cross the bridge?
Yeah. I didn't give that order. I just explained to the captain, actually, what the guy had said, and he's the one that made the decision.
So, again, you may have saved a lot of lives.
Maybe. Who knows?
But very soon after that, your life was in danger.
Well, while I was in the front line with glasses watching what was going on, that's when I suppose it could have been a mortar shell from our side, but I don't think so. I think it was a mortar shell that the Germans.
And where did it hit?
Right behind me.
How close?
Oh, probably less than 10 feet.
Less than 10 feet. So you get shrapnel in your legs and in your rear end.
Yeah, but mostly in the radio.
Mostly in the radio.
Yeah.
So when you got the Silver Star, you'd left the radio behind in your foxhole.
Yeah.
Good thing you had it on your back this time.
Right. Absolutely right.
What do you think would have happened if you weren't wearing that radio?
I'd be dead.
Because that shrapnel would have gone right through your rib cage and into all your internal organs.
Right.
Well, that's a pretty close call, isn't it?
Right.
Did it take you a minute to figure that out, to figure out what kind of shape you were in?
Oh, yeah. And I called for the medic. The medic gave me some morphine and says, go back to the first aid station.
And how long did it take you to recover?
About 3 weeks.
You're out of commission for 3 weeks. What'd you think about during that time?
I don't know. I was dazed.
When you're in that situation, does that thought enter your mind? Wow, that could have been me?
Oh, yeah, of course.
And I just think of everything that you've accomplished in your life since the war. None of these things would have ever happened.
Right.
And there's a lot of chemistry and medicine innovations that have occurred because you're still alive. So they let you out of the hospital.
Yeah, to replacement depot.
Which means you're probably going to join some other unit where you don't know anybody.
Right, and my job was at night to sit without weapon and make sure that none of the prisoners escape, because they were afraid that we're going to shoot prisoners.
And these are German prisoners?
Yeah.
Did you talk to many of them?
No. I was in no condition.
But you recognized something?
Yeah, a truck from our battalion, the big trucks that were marked B Battalion, 79th Infantry Division.
What'd you do?
Well, I talked to the driver, and he said, get in, I'll take you back to your battalion.
You didn't have orders for that, though?
No. I was AWL on paper, but the colonel took care of us.
And this is the colonel who you'd had a long-standing relationship
yeah,
with?
Yeah.
He's the one that wanted you over there because of your German skills. So what happened from there, the rest of your time over there in Europe before the surrender?
Okay.
What were some of the things you did and some of the things that stand out?
We went across Germany pretty easily. We didn't have to do much fighting and landed up in Czechoslovakia near the city of Marienbad, Marianska in Czech. After a week or two, the colonel got orders to join the 1st Division in Nuremberg, and Colonel called Ike and had me transferred with him, essentially. It was separate. He went first, but just a couple of days later.
And up until this point, have you gotten any clues to what happened to your family?
No, not until I went to Munich to the headquarters where all the records were kept and looked at the records. And I found out later the records were not accurate.
Well, I want to understand what this was like for you. And again, keeping in mind that you're still a very young man. So you're ordered to Nuremberg, and they're going to have you interrogate war criminals because you speak such great German.
Yeah.
Now, these are the war criminals that wanted to kill you and any other Jew they could find.
Yeah.
But to that point, you were okay with that idea.
I was hesitant even then.
Yeah.
You shouldn't say. I was not ready to tell my colonel no.
Sure.
But after seeing the records.
So tell me about this. So you go to Munich, and what's in Munich?
All the records are kept in Munich.
And you mean all the records from the entire Holocaust?
Yeah. They were later transferred to another place, and any correction were made. The Holocaust Museum in Washington put me up to that, to go to the records at the other place.
Uh-huh.
To make sure, like they had, my parents were loaded in a cattle train, and in Munich it said they were taken to Riga, Latvia, executed there, but the train never made it to Riga. It stopped.
What I want to understand is what knowledge you are receiving at the time, because you get to Munich, and here is this vast trove of records. Was it a needle in a haystack to find your family in there?
No, no. It was filed under my regular name, Rice.
So you look up Rice.
Yeah.
And as you get to that spot, is your heart pounding a little bit? Or did you think you already knew what you were going to find?
I think I knew what I was going to find. I had enough stories. When we went across from the Rhine to Czechoslovakia, we were very close to the Belsen concentration.
Bergen-Belsen,
And there, you know, in the army, rumors fly. We knew that it was very bad.
But now you're opening up a file.
Yeah.
And you see right there, and it has your parents' name.
Yeah, it's in here. The only thing that was wrong is that it didn't go to Riga. The gate went to Kaunas.
But you're looking at a paper that says your parents are dead.
Yeah, and my grandparents. My grandparents went to Theresienstadt.
And what about your brother?
Oh, he went with my parents.
What did that do to you, to see that in print?
Oh, it's hard to take, let's put it this way. If I would have had a German that was bothering me, I might have shot him, without question.
So you find out that your parents, your grandparents, your brother are all victims of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're also thinking at some point, that's what would have happened to me.
Sure.
Yet you go back to Nuremberg, and they still expect you to interrogate these guys.
Yeah.
So what'd you do?
I told the colonel I couldn't do it emotionally, and he understood.
So instead, they have you taking care of hotel rooms for the jurors who are coming in for the Nuremberg trials.
Yeah.
And then they give you a pretty interesting job, one that still is impacting what people in Germany read today, right?
Sure.
Tell me what you did.
Well, we started the first German newspaper, interrogated the personnel that did not have any Nazi affiliation, that they were clean. We started the first German newspaper, and it's still in the same paper, Süddeutsche Zeitung, is still working.
And there's a funny story there about they got tired of seeing that same Gothic typeface that Hitler had used, right?
Yeah.
So we don't want this anymore.
No, it was the Americans that objected. The Germans didn't object.
But the Americans said, that's Hitler's type font.
That's right.
And we want you to find another printing press with Roman style.
Yeah.
And you couldn't do that.
There was no type available.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned something there. As you are vetting the people who are going to work for this newspaper, it's up to you to decide whether or not they were Nazi sympathizers?
There was a committee of 5 or 6 army people doing it.
How seriously did you take that job?
Very seriously.
Well, yeah, I would think so. And how could you, what was the determining factor for you?
How much were they actively involved in Nazi propaganda? That had to be that they were in the army, that was not a criterion because they were drafted. But how active were they actually in the Nazi party?
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically saying, good, bad, good, bad, good, bad.
That's what they wanted us to do.
Yeah.
The Germans wanted to start the opera again. When we asked them, what opera are you going to use? Oh, they said, we're doing a Wagnerian opera. I said, you're not doing the Wagnerian opera. Then they said, how about Fidelio? That's the only opera that Beethoven wrote.
Uh-huh.
And I said, sure, go ahead. But we did reserve the King's Loge for American personnel.
Uh-huh.
I saw Fidelio 3 times.
Some people may not understand why you were so opposed to Wagner or any of his music.
Well, Wagner was an anti-Semite of first degree, associated with the Nazi Party, and our maid in our house occasionally worked in Wagner's house, and she says he's the biggest woman hater she's seen.
So there was no way you were going to sign off on Wagnerian operas.
No.
So Beethoven it was. And eventually, I know we can't possibly cover your whole career here, but here's a guy who has escaped Hitler's Third Reich as a Jew, makes it to America, doesn't speak any English, makes it through college, gets a degree in animal science, runs a dairy before he ends up in the army, gets a Silver Star, he's wounded in action, Purple Heart, this incredible turn of events at the end of the war where you get to see in your own hands what happened to your parents. You're working around the biggest names in the American government. You're around Eisenhower and all kinds of people. And then you come back to the States. You turn down a commission that they offered you in the Army. You come home and go back to college and end up in a long career in biochemistry. You got your PhD at the University of Chicago. And while you're there, here comes another famous name. You knew Enrico Fermi?
Yes. A very humble man.
Uh-huh.
Extremely humble.
How did you get to know him?
The first meeting of Enrico Fermi was very interesting from science point of view. I went to a seminar on physiology by a very famous physiologist called Shedlovsky.
Uh-huh.
And he had developed a formula for nerve conduction. And Fermi went there because he thought this formula was incorrect. So they argued about the electronics of nerve conduction.
You knew who he was and how significant he was.
Now I talked to him. And I met him many times in the chemistry department. He used to come over quite a bit.
And you use the word humble, and you have a funny story that illustrates that. When your brother-in-law came to visit?
Yeah, I showed him the West Stands where the reactor was.
So this is where they'd carried out the Manhattan Project.
Yeah. The reason for it was that Fermi was originally in New York.
Uh-huh.
But there was no way that they felt they would have anything as dangerous as the first nuclear reactor in New York City.
Yeah.
The West Stands were not used at all. Since it was in the football field, they were thinking it was a little safer distance from everything else. It wasn't. If it would have gone bad, it would have been terrible.
It would have been disaster.
Yeah.
So you're right there where all this has happened, and your brother-in-law is with you.
Yeah.
And what happened next?
A big Cadillac drove up,
uh-huh.
And my brother-in-law asked, is this Enrico Fermi? I said, no, that's the electrician. And then a very dilapidated one-speed bicycle drove up, and that was Fermi.
Did he believe you, your brother-in-law?
He believed anything I said.
Well, a lot of people wouldn't believe your life story. It's kind of hard to believe. It's pretty. Do you ever think about that? How improbable your story is?
Yeah.
And that's just at the University of Chicago, where you're getting your PhD. You work around a lot of Nobel Prize winners, and you end up with a long career lecturing at Johns Hopkins, and then moving here to Colorado in 1959. But even while you're at Johns Hopkins, Salk and Sabin designed the polio vaccine, yeah. And you're there with Sabin and the monkeys he experimented on.
Oh, those monkeys were terrible. They had to wear gloves that had steel in them. The handlers, I used to watch them. Uh-huh. They bit, they were really nasty. And those were the only strain of monkeys that could be used for that purpose.
So you rubbed shoulders with some of the people who changed science and medicine in the 20th century. Fermi and Sabin were just a couple, but you would leave your own impact, and I don't think we could even count the number of people listening right now who have probably taken a potentially life-saving test that you came up with. Oscar Rice will explain which test that is when we come back. Check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll get the rest of this 95-year-old's incredible story right after this.